Good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, September 29th. It's a Monday. And let's take a look at the schedule first. Should I get my microphone on? Looks good. Mostly good. All right, so today is the 29th. And we're going to cover joints today. That's chapter 9. And notice that you don't have to read the whole chapter, just those pages that are outlined in your syllabus. And your next exam is October 13th. So how many weeks away is that? How many weeks away is that? One, two. 2 weeks away. 2 weeks away. And it's chapters 7, 8, 9. What are we covering today? 9, then 10, and 11. So we got to still cover two more chapters after today. And don't forget, the Monday class has the second practicum on the same day. And the Wednesday class gets a break this time. So there's no lecture exam, just a practicum on that Wednesday. So we switch back and forth. And then I think the exam number 3, Monday has it again because lab practicum 4, last day of the semester, the Wednesday group will have a practicum and a lecture exam at the same time. That's because there's no finals week anymore. All right, so just be prepared to tackle those. And that might actually be good. You might actually like to have a practicum and a lecture exam on the same day because it kind of covers the same material, right? So it just reinforces what you're learning. I'm not sure. Probably everybody's a little bit different. Okay, so does anybody have a question regarding schedule of things at all? The Monday groups have their practicums graded. Wednesday's practicums will be graded pretty soon. And I'll see you guys in lecture later on today. All right, so today, chapter 9, which is joints. And I think you're going to notice something a little bit different about this particular chapter because it's going to be a little bit more like physiology compared to anatomy. There's definitely some anatomy, but you'll have to understand how certain things work a little bit more than typically how you've had to do that in the past. All right, so let me turn some of these lights down. I like that one down, like that one down, like that one down. Good. Is that too dark? You're okay? Okay. So we can classify joints by their structure, which is pure anatomy, or we can classify joints by their structure, their function. All right, so a joint, another name for a joint is articulation. This is where two bones come together, or maybe they don't quite come together, but they're attached somehow, maybe through some ligaments or cartilage, right? So an articulation is just some kind of association between two different bones. We call that a joint. We can classify joints either by their structure or by their function, and you see that there are some subcategories of these things as well. So structural classification is based on the material that joins the bones together. And here are some joints. The sheet that I was trying to pull up is a sheet that would give you some examples of fibrous, cartilaginous, and synovial. And I'll make sure that's in Blackboard for you. I actually wanted you to copy that down right now. But anyway, I'll point some of these things out. So a fibrous joint pretty much is put together just like it says, right? So there are fibers between two bones. One good example would be a suture. And if you want to name one particular suture, what's your favorite suture? Nasofrontal? Lambdoidal? Squamosal? Okay, those would be all good examples of a fibrous type of joint. And these are found in the skull. Another kind is what we call a syndesmosis. So the distal tibiofibular joint right here, there's a ligament that stabilizes the ankle joint or the association between the tibia and fibula. So this is still a fibrous kind of joint. And then the third example of a fibrous joint would be a gomphosis. And you saw the mandibles and maxilla in lab, and every once in a while some of those skulls would lose a tooth and you'd look down into this big cavity. What's this big cavity called? Yeah, that's an alveolus, right? And the root of a tooth fits into that alveolus. And there is a ligament between the alveolar process and the tooth, we call that a periodontal ligament. Oh, it says right there, a periodontal ligament, and that's what holds the tooth in place. So it's a pretty strong ligament because your teeth should not be wiggling around inside your mouth. So under fibrous, I would put sutural, syndesmosis, and gomphosis, and maybe give me an example of each one of those. And gomphosis, this is the only example of a gomphosis that I know of. If somebody else finds another example of a gomphosis, let me know. I'll include it in lecture. Of course, I suppose I could always Google that myself. All right, so those are all fibrous joints. All right, another kind of classification is cartilaginous. And I suppose you can imagine what a cartilaginous joint has. Different than fibrous, it's going to have cartilage of some kind. And again, I would like for you to have some examples of this. One would be a synchondrosis, and bones are joined with hyaline cartilage. So not elastic cartilage, not fibrocartilage, but just plain old hyaline cartilage. A good example of a synchondrosis will be the epiphyseal plate, prepubertal plate, so this is that growth plate. It is cartilage, and then also covering the epiphyses of bones. So that's what we call, well, actually, you know what? Don't write down covering the epiphyses of bones. Right? But write down epiphyseal plate right here, because we're going to talk about that in a little bit. All right. Another one is going to be the manubriosternal joint. Okay, and or the manubriocostal joint. So here's a rib, and that's between rib number 1 and the manubrium. And that's a nice immovable joint. The epiphyseal plate is an immovable joint. And, of course, that's only between ribs number 1 and the manubrium. Those are synchondroses. A symphysis is fibrocartilage. Some examples of symphyses would be the intervertebral disc, right, and the pubic symphysis. And, of course, that tells you right in the name that it is a symphysis. That is fibrocartilage. That's another kind of cartilaginous joint. So jot down intervertebral. And then synovial, the last classification. Here is a typical synovial joint, and we're going to go over some of the details of this one. All right, it has hyaline cartilage over the epiphyses of the bones that are articulating, and it's got a cavity filled with synovial fluid, and there is a synovial membrane that secretes synovial fluid into the synovial cavity. And then to help stabilize that synovial membrane, there is a fibrous capsule over the whole joint. Right? And if we put the synovial membrane with fibrous capsule together, then we get something called the articular capsule. So articular capsule has got those two components to it, the fibrous and synovial membrane. And then sometimes there is a ligament that spans across the whole joint that further stabilizes the joint. So here is a ligament that goes from the proximal to the distal bone in this particular joint. So this is a typical synovial joint, and I'm sure this is an exam figure because we use this to understand many, many joints in our body. So synovial joint. And for synovial joints, what kind of joint would we want to use? Well, you could use a knee as an example, a shoulder, okay, elbow. Those are all synovial joints. Okay. All right, so then we could classify joints by what their function is. And so some joints are immovable, some are slightly movable, and some are freely movable. And the immovable ones are what we call a synarthrosis. The slightly movable are the amphiarthrosis, and the freely movable are the diarthroses. All right, so you're going to have to remember these three names, and it's not too hard to remember the order from no mobility to most mobility, because if you look at the first letter of these three terms, what does that spell out for you? It should be happy, but it doesn't. It says sad, S-A-D, okay? All right, so a synarthrosis, immovable, right? And a good example of that would be a suture. And by structure, what kind of joint is a suture? It's a fibrous joint. Yeah, as a nice example of a fibrous joint. Amphiarthrosis, slightly movable, like the intervertebral discs, right? Because you can rotate slightly. And what did we give that as an example of? a cartilaginous, right? That was one example of a cartilaginous, right? And then a freely movable is going to be a synovial joint. And that's the last one that we looked at. So all synovial joints are diarthroses, but not all diarthroses are synovial. Okay. All right, so there's some terminology to understand right here. Oh, here's a little of what I just mentioned. Okay, so sutures are movable, right? And they're located between bones of the skull. And some are synarthroses, and they're immovable. Syndesmosis, connected exclusively by ligaments, right? And the amount of mobility all depends on the kind of ligament that is there attaching the bones together. I'm going to have to go to here and let's look. I lost it. Well, the interosseous membrane between the ulna and radius and between the tibia and fibula. Okay, that's a ligamentous kind of joint, but it is freely movable because you can pronate and supinate your hand. The distotibiofibular joint is immovable. All right, and then here's what I mentioned, the radial ulnar interosseous membrane, that's a diarthrosis, which is freely movable, even though it's a syndesmosis joint. And a gomphosis is what? It's just a synarthrosis because it is immovable. And that just attaches a tooth to the alveolus via the periodontal ligament. Cartilaginous joints. Let's see, we talked about synchondroses, hyaline cartilage, symphysis united by fibrocartilage. I didn't realize I had it really nicely laid out here for everybody to see. Okay, then synovial joints. It's a type of structural classification, but what can you tell me about all synovial joints? Even though synovial is a structural classification, we should know something about its function, and it is always going to be a diarthrosis. They're always a diarthrosis. All right, so here are the pieces of a typical synovial joint as articular cartilage. Where would we find articular cartilage on a synovial joint? Over the epiphyses of bones, right? Articular cartilage is just a hyaline cartilage, and it's kind of spongy and smooth and slippery. It prevents the ends of bones from grinding each other away. And every once in a while, this articular cartilage is damaged, maybe to inappropriate use of a joint, or maybe somebody's immune system actually attacks the cartilage and destroys the cartilage between bones. And what kind of condition do we call that? What kind of pathological condition is that when your cartilage, right, is no longer covering the ends of bones? That is arthritis. Yeah, that is arthritis. Sometimes, and it used to be a fatal disease, but I think they have some pretty good treatment for that now. All right, the joint cavity, and inside the joint cavity you have synovial fluid. The deepest layer of the joint cavity is that synovial membrane, and the synovial membrane secretes, or sometimes we say just weeps fluid into the joint cavity or synovial cavity. Right, and so here's the synovial cavity filled with synovial fluid. Reinforcing ligaments, like I see on this illustration, are commonly found. You might have nerves and blood vessels associated with the capsule. And you might also have a bursa or a tendon sheath associated with a synovial joint. So let me show you what, I tell you what, before we go there, does anybody have a question of what a typical synovial joint looks like? Okay, just remember it has a central cavity right here filled with synovial fluid, and that synovial fluid lubricates the hyaline cartilage. All right, so it's nice and slippery, and it also maintains the health of this hyaline cartilage because hyaline cartilage is avascular, doesn't have any blood vessels. But there are living cells in there. What are those living cells called? Anybody remember what these living cells in hyaline cartilage are called? Yeah, there are chondrocytes and lacunae, so they do need nourishment, and they get nourishment from the synovial membrane via the synovial fluid, which is not a lot. That's why cartilage, once it's damaged, really does not regenerate itself. All right, so synovial fluid and this hyaline cartilage make for a very slippery surface. So let's talk about a bursa. Where is a bursa? Here is an example of the shoulder joint. And you can see a nice epiphyseal line right here, hyaline cartilage over the epiphysis, and you can see it articulating with the glenoid fossa, and it's underneath the acromion process, so the acromion process, a big bony mass, right? And it would bump up against the head of the humerus, but there's something that protects the head of the humerus from being ground down by the acromion process, and that is a bursa. And when I look at a bursa, I kind of think of it as a pillow. And the structure of this pillow is exactly the same as the joint capsule. So we see that it has a fibrous capsule, has a synovial membrane, and it has a cavity, and a synovial membrane weeps synovial fluid into the center of this bursa. Right? And as you move the shoulder joint, this bursa can roll around, and it just prevents abrasion and friction from developing between the head of the humerus and the acromion process. All right, so here you can see how the bursa kind of squishes around a little bit, and it just protects the head of the humerus, namely this articular cartilage. Now, there can be an inflammation if you overuse a joint or use it improperly. This bursa right here can become inflamed, right, and more fluid is going to build up in the cavity. And, of course, when fluid builds up in the cavity, that produces more inflammation, which produces more fluid building up in the cavity, produces more inflammation, and it gets to a point to where it can be very painful. So what do we call that when you have an inflamed bursa? Okay, and that's kind of ironic because a bursa is supposed to prevent inflammation, right? But in this particular case, right, if you overdo it, it becomes inflamed itself, which causes more inflammation. So again, I didn't let you guys tell me what the answer was. What's the answer for an inflamed bursa? I mean, what do we call an inflamed bursa? Yeah, that's what we call. Oh, somebody said it. Okay. Edema is swelling, so I kind of like that. The process you might call edema, all right? But the pathology is what we call bursitis. Right, and that's due to, that you could consider that an edema of this little pillow right here. All right, so its job is to prevent inflammation between structures that are moving up against each other. All right, and if we look at the humerus, I see a tendon. What kind of tissue is a tendon? What does it join? Bone to muscle, yeah. And it's, remember, dense regular connective tissue. It's really, really strong. Here is a tendon from the biceps, and I think you kind of know where the biceps is, right? It's in your anterior arm, and it goes all the way across the shoulder, so it helps with this motion that I'm doing right now. It helps with that motion. And that tendon goes right over the top of the head of the humerus, and it inserts into this, what we call the supraglenoid tubercle. There's a special little process right here for attaching the head of the biceps brachii. And so, as you can see, then there's a lot of motion associated with this tendon. And just like there is a bursa that protects inflammation or prevents inflammation between the acromion and the head of the humerus, there is something that's almost like a bursa that's protecting the head of the humerus and this tendon from becoming inflamed. And basically, it's just that pillow that wraps around a tendon, and that's what we call a tendon sheath. So if a tendon is moving over some bony structure in your body, maybe even another muscle or some ligaments, typically it's surrounded with this tendon sheath, which allows motion to take place without inflammation, right? And can you see this is just kind of a pillow that's been wrapped around this tendon? So that's a tendon sheath, very similar to this bursa. Okay. One last thing that we have with synovial joints, let me see if I can find it. It has to do with an articular disc. And articular disc, we have in a couple joints, like the TMJ. What is the TMJ? TMJ. What's a TMJ? It's a joint between the temporal bone and the mandible, right? So it's here, the temporomandibular joint. All right, here is, all right, so here is the knee. Knee has an articular disc. We're not looking inside the joint yet. We just see a bunch of ligaments, stabilizing ligaments. We see some tendons and more ligaments, some more tendons over here stabilizing the knee. We're going to look at this in just a second. But if we look on the interior of a knee, right, for sure we can see the articular surface of the femur covered with hyaline cartilage. And the head of the tibia also has hyaline cartilage on it. But here is some fibrocartilage, these C-shaped structures, all right, and these are what we call a meniscus, but a meniscus is just a special form of an articular disc, even though it kind of doesn't look like a complete disc in this particular tissue. And that articular disc just provides for the correct motion and stabilizing of a joint, like, for instance, the knee joint or the TMJ. And so those would be really good examples. Really good examples, and also, okay, look at this articular disc between the clavicle and the manubrium, all right? So this joint right here between the clavicle and the manubrium is a lot like what other kind of joint that you have in your body, because it has an articular disc. Kind of strange to think of it, but probably it's good that you recognize that. This clavicular manubrial joint is a lot like your knee, for instance, right? Because your knee has that articular disc. And is very similar to the TMJ. Okay, so here is external acoustic meatus, styloid process. Right here is the condyle of the mandible. And here is the articular cartilage on the condyle. Here's some articular cartilage right in the mandibular fossa. Then here's a synovial cavity with synovial fluid. And look what's separating, what else is separating the mandible from the temporal bone, and that is another articular disc. All right, so the TMJ is a fairly complicated joint as well. But what kind of joint is a TMJ by function? What are your choices of joints by function? You have? You have, what's the least movable? Synarthrosis, and what's the next one? Amphiarthrosis, and the freely movable is the diarthrosis. So of those three, which one is the temporomandibular joint? It is the diarthrosis, because it's freely movable. And as a matter of fact, it's the only diarthrosis that you have in the skull. All the other joints are fibrous and immovable, right? Which are sutures. Okay? So sutures, they are synarthroses, and the TMJ is the only diarthroses, and it's noteworthy that it has this articular disc. So that's a synovial type fluid. Okay, functions of synovial joints, and again, a synovial joint is what kind of joint by function? Synovial is structure, is a structural classification, but all synovial joints are diarthroses. They're freely movable. Okay, and so the shapes of the matching bones, right, have to complement each other. The articulating surfaces have a particular configuration which stabilizes the joint. And there are ligaments that can stabilize a joint as well. But probably one of the most important things for stabilizing a joint is muscle tone. And if someone ever damages a joint, right, we can't really resurface or restructure what a joint looks like. And it's really difficult to replace ligaments, though sometimes that's fairly successful. Right? But the best and easiest way to stabilize a joint after it's damaged is by working the muscles that go across that particular joint. So we haven't looked at muscles just yet, but maybe if somebody has a knee injury, what they do to help their knee injury is to exercise muscles that are in their thigh or in their calf. And in so doing, right, then those muscles and put extra tension on these ligaments. Even if the ligaments were stretched out by that injury, the muscles can shorten and reapply that tension to the ligaments. And that stabilizes the joint. All right, so we talked about bursa and tendon sheaths already. That's kind of like a mini synovial joint, right? It prevents inflammation between two bony structures or a tendon and a bone or a ligament and a bone. And we have these bursa all over our bodies. All right, let's talk about movements of what kind of joint is freely movable again? By structure, it's a synovial, and by function, it's a diarthrosis. All right, and now all of your synovial joints can perform the same kind of function. All right, so some are gliding. Bones can glide over another bone. Like, for instance, the wrist. Wrist bones are like that. What do we call wrist bones? Yeah, they're carpals. All right, so here is a gliding, sometimes we call it a plane joint, so this allows for some motion in your wrist and your ankles. Angular motions. Well, I'm really glad we're talking about these because I really need to start using these proper terms in anatomy. It's difficult to speak anatomy to you without knowing these terms. Angular motions, all right, are always in pairs, antagonistic pairs, like flexion and extension. So what the heck is flexion and extension? All right, one good example would be at a hinge joint, like in the elbow. And so just keep your palm in anatomic position, and when you move your elbow, what happens? Okay, your forearm, right, is elevated and almost touches the humerus right here. You could think of the joint when you have your hand straight out like that, that across the elbow, it is just now straight. 180 degrees, right? And if we contract that biceps, the angle gets what between the forearm and the arm? It gets less. So here's it, 90 degrees and less than 90 degrees. All right, so if you ever have two bones and the angle between them starts to decrease, we call that flexion. And you have some muscles that work for flexion. And if you start to increase the angle between those two bones, we call that extension, right? And so extension and flexion are antagonistic to each other. Is that a bad thing? No, that's a really good thing, remember? And you have two different major muscle groups that are also then antagonistic to that particular motion. All right, so antagonistic motion provides for precise control and balance of your forearm, your hand. You know exactly where it goes. And probably somebody could give me an example of last Saturday night. Who could give me a pretty good example of you were demonstrating a good antagonistic motion? Anybody have a good example to think of? Were you ever pulled over last Saturday by the person in the fancy blue uniform, badge, and sidearm? Okay, and what would they ask you to do? Put your finger out, close your eyes, and put your fingertip right on the tip of your nose. Right? And why would you be able to do that if you're not intoxicated? Because you had precise control and balance of your fingertips due to the antagonistic arrangement of, for instance, the biceps brachii and the triceps brachii. All right, the biceps is in your anterior arm, and to figure out an antagonistic muscle to that, you would just automatically go to the posterior arm. Right? So antagonistic by opposite, by opposing muscle compartments. You're going to find that to be a really important rule. All right, so that's flexion and extension. Abduction and adduction. These are antagonistic motions once again, and we can do that kind of motion with your fingers. We can do that with your upper appendage, your toes, your lower appendage. All right, so take your upper appendage and elevate it once again at the shoulder. And as you bring your arm back down to your side, don't just let it drop, but bring it back down to your side, we call that adduction. All right, so when you bring something to midline, that is adduction. When you move it away from midline, right, that is abduction. So abduction, you can do that with your legs, you can do that with your fingers as well. All right, at this largest knuckle joint, which is a joint between a phalange and a metacarpal. Okay, so that can abduct and adduct. All right, now what about a joint between two phalanges? Okay, can you abduct and adduct this one right here? No, you can't. All right, what would happen if it did abduct or adduct at this particular joint? Well, something would break, right? Something would rip. So joints can only be used in the way that their structure has determined that they can work. So the joints between the phalanges, the interphalangeal joints, are hinge joints. And hinge joints can't abduct and adduct. Circumduction is an angular motion. There are two joints in your body that can circumduct, and think of a windmill motion. So any kind of ball and socket joint will allow for circumduction. Right? So I'm doing that with my shoulder right now. You can do that with your hip, circumduction. So what the heck is circumduction? It's a combination of a number of kinds of motions. Like what motion did we say this was? What was this? This is abduction, and this is adduction. Okay, and we didn't talk about this one just yet. I'm going to have to come back to this in a second. Okay, what about at the hip? All right, so if I look at my thigh and my trunk, can you see that it's making a line? What's the angle across my hip right now? Is it 90 degrees? It's 180, right? Okay, so if I bring my thigh up to my waist, right, what happens to this angle? It's decreasing. Yeah, it's becoming, it went to 90 degrees. What do we call that when the angle decreases? That's flexion. Okay, so at the hip, right, this is flexion. And so when I put my foot back down, what's that motion? That's extension, right? So flexion and extension. And as a matter of fact, the hip, you can actually move your thigh back behind you. That's what we call hyperextension, right? So from here to here is extension. From here to here is hyperextension. Some joints you can hyperextend, no problem. But other joints, like the joint between your phalanges, you can't hyperextend that. Maybe some people can a little bit with practice, but you can't. Your knee, you should never hyperextend, right? Only these certain kind of joints. All right, so can you appreciate that very easily, that at the hip this is flexion and this is extension? Okay. Your shoulder can flex and extend as well. But it's difficult to see this because I can't model it in my mind as a decrease in angle or an increase in angle. So start an anatomic position and only consider the shoulder. If I raise my hand up like that, that is flexion. I don't see a change in angle between them. All right, so if you can remember that, memorize that, that's fine. And if you bring your arm back down to your side, that's not adduction, that is extension. So we got flexion, extension, and what else can you do? You can hyperextend, right? So circumduction is a combination of all of those motions. Flexion, extension, hyperextension, abduction, adduction, all working together, and that happens at a ball and socket joint. Okay, so here is an easy trick that I think of, for instance, when I'm in lab, because it's really hard for me to memorize that. When I move my arm like this, okay, what did I just do? I flexed. I have a hard time remembering. That's flexion. But I just think of my shoulder and my hip together, because what's this at the hip? What did I just do at the hip? So here is flexion. Here is extension. Here is hyperextension. So just think of your hip and standing straight like this, right? So flexion at the hip, flexion at the shoulder. Extension, hyperextension at the shoulder. Okay. Rotation of a bone along its long axis, right? It's just what we call a rotation. And what two bones allow for rotation? Well, between atlas and axis, for instance, so that you can rotate your head like that. And another really good example would be the radial ulnar joint, where the head of the radius rotates within the radial notch of the ulna. Uh-oh, some of you didn't have lab yet. Well, we're going to look, well, we had a lecture anyway on these long bones, but you're going to really appreciate that in lab. Okay, so, that is rotation. Okay, oh, here it is. Right here. So here is a nice pivot joint allows for rotation. Okay, I want to talk about some other kinds of motions. So these are really handy to know because I've been trying to use these terms already in class a number of times, but you didn't know what I was talking about. So let's get these down so that I can speak properly. Okay, in the forearm, in anatomic position, which way are the thumbs pointing? Okay, when I'm relaxed like that, am I in anatomic position right now? I'm not, okay? So I need my palms facing anteriorly, okay? And we say that now my forearm is supinated when they're facing anteriorly. And when I move them posteriorly, I notice I didn't do anything with the shoulder. I just moved my forearm. Now the palms of my hands are facing posteriorly. We say that is pronated. So supination is when you go from a pronated to supinated form. And so a good way to remember what is supinated, if you put your two hands together when you're in a supinated position, you make a soup bowl. All right, so that's an easy thing to remember, supinated versus pronation. Or pronation, supination. All right, and that's allowed because the elbow joint is pretty fancy because of that proximal radial ulnar joint. Allows for rotation of the radius within the radial notch of the ulna, and that allows the bones to cross over each other. All right, so that is the reason why anatomic position seems a little bit awkward when your thumbs are pointing laterally, because in that position, the radius and ulna do not cross over each other. Right? If you're in a pronated position, then the radius crosses over the ulna. So that's not a simple description of the forearm or look to the forearm. Dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. It has to do with the ankle joint. All right. Well, let's look at the hand, the wrist joint. All right. So if I go, here's a really good trick question. If I go like that, what did I just do? Should I do it again? I'm going to stay here, and then I go like that. What is that? Okay. I tricked you. Okay. So I'll come back to that in just a second. All right. So now I got my hand straight. What is this motion? Okay. Just at my wrist. Okay. So I'm not talking about dorsiflexion or plantar flexion at the moment. I'm going to get there in just a second. So that is flexion. Now what is this motion going back? Extension. So now what is this motion? That is hyperextension, right? So I can see why you would want to call that flexion because that angle is decreasing, right? But it's this angle here that we're most interested in. Okay, so flexion at the wrist, extension at the wrist, hyperextension. All right, well, you probably have noticed even before you take an anatomy class that your upper appendage, the orientation is completely different compared to your lower appendage because... Right. If I were to flex at the elbow, it would produce this motion. But if I flex at the knee, my leg doesn't go anteriorly, right? It goes where? It goes posteriorly. My heel goes backwards, right? So here is flexion at the elbow. Here is flexion at the knee. So some of the joints are twisted around. They're rotated a little bit differently. So we don't have a nice simple flexion and extension at the ankle. So here are the terms that we use. So when you point your toes into the ground, another way of doing that is maybe just stand on your toes like that. That's you're pushing your toes into the ground. That's what we call plantar flexion. Right? Plantar flexion. And if you lift your toes up off the ground, that's what we call dorsiflexion. So plantar flexion, dorsiflexion, because your ankle joint is just a whole different arrangement compared to your wrist. Right, so they're both considered flexion motions. Plantar, just think of what, planting your toes into the ground. Dorsi is elevating your foot or toes. You know, it used to be when you'd go see a doctor would be in the room, you walk into the room, as you walk into the room, doctor would look at you, and a lot of times they'd make a diagnosis just as you walk in the room, right, because they could see you walking and how you're orienting yourself. Now, that's not the case. Now, patient's in the room, doctor walks in, patient can analyze the doctor. Is he walking normally or not? Well, and pretty soon, I'm sure it's not going to be one doctor, one patient. Pretty soon, I'm sure there's going to be like five patients in the room, and a doctor will come in and will diagnose all five people at the same time. And I kid all my doctor friends a lot because I say, well, I teach many people at one time. If I can teach 100 students at one time, how come you can't diagnose a patient, 100 patients at one time? And they just kind of moan and groan. But I'm sure it's going to go in that direction sooner or later. So anyway, when doctors could watch somebody walk, okay, they would also look at the tips of their shoes. Why would a physician or a healthcare provider look at the tips of somebody's shoes? Okay, because, for instance, when you're walking, if you can't dorsiflex, what's going to happen to your toes if you can't dorsiflex? If you can't lift your toes up off the ground and you drag your foot over the ground like that, right, it's going to wear down the tips of the shoes. And that's a really important sign for something. If somebody can't dorsiflex, can't lift their toes up off the ground, usually it has nothing to do with their ankle, usually it has nothing to do with muscles in their legs, but that's a nice sign that it could be a spinal cord injury, right, because nerve conduction is being blocked down to that part of the body. Now, why do you think that would be important? To know, were there some really important consequences for somebody that doesn't lift their toes up off the ground when they're walking? What could happen? Yeah, you could trip. And when you're in our age group, that's not such a big deal because when you trip, right, you can catch yourself, get your balance back right away or grab something. But when you're 80 years old, guess what happens? Chances are you're just going to fall. And when you fall, when you're in that age, 85, 90, maybe 80 years old, if you have osteoporosis, what's going to happen? Yeah, you could break a hip or an adduction bone or maybe a femur, something like that. And what kind of convalescence is that for somebody of that age group? That's tough, right? Chances are you can't be at home when you have a fractured hip like that. You have to be in a convalescence home. And what happens to somebody when they're in that age group and you take them away from their family, you take them away from their familiar surroundings? Well, it's one scenario that happens frequently. Yeah, they actually kind of give up on life, right? And they just expire in a nursing home, even if they're visited by family members, just because it's such a weird location. All right, so these motions are pretty important. You could save somebody's life in a way of thinking about it, okay? So that's why it's important to know dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, as an example, for instance. Okay, inversion, eversion of the foot. I don't have any really good examples, stills of this, but that's when you rock your ankle to where you stand on the lateral side of your ankle like that, or stand on the medial side of your foot, lateral side of your foot or medial side of your foot. So your ankle is just moving like this. When you invert, it's, for instance, like standing on the lateral margin of your foot. That's an inversion of the ankle. That's relatively easy to do because you have a big range of motion and you don't have really strong muscles necessarily holding that ankle in position. You don't have very strong ligaments. So if you twist your ankle that way, it's easy to invert. And that damages the ankle and ligaments down there. If you evert, standing on the medial edge of your foot, that's relatively difficult to do. You have more ligaments that stabilize, all right, or prevent that kind of motion. But if you ever do evert your ankle seriously, then that's a much more troublesome kind of trauma to your ankle. That's a worse kind of accident, even because it's stronger, because you have more ligaments. More ligaments are going to be damaged. Okay, protraction and retraction. Whenever you have some body parts and you push things out anteriorly, we call that protraction. When you take that body part and move it back, right, that is retraction. So things that can protract and retract, for instance, your shoulders. You can push forward, that's protraction, or you can pull back, that's retraction. Protraction, retraction. Can do the same thing with that temporomandibular joint. Temporomandibular joint is pretty fascinating because you can push your mandible forward, don't break a tooth, right? And then you could pull it back like that. So you can protract and retract at the mandible. But there's other things you can do with a TMJ, right? Which is this next one right here, elevation and depression. So when you open your mouth, that is called depression of the mandible. And when you raise your mandible up, that is elevation. You can kind of do that with your eyelids too, your upper eyelid. You can elevate or you can depress. Open your eyes, close your eyes. All right. Another kind of motion, opposition. There's only one joint where opposition works, and that has to do with a digit. And it's your thumb. What digit number is your thumb? Can anybody remember what the digit number for thumb is? Yeah, number one. Okay. All right, so with the thumb, not only can you flex and extend, maybe even hyperextend a little bit. Okay, what else can you do with this thumb? Ah, you can move it anteriorly like this. So there are two ways that your thumb can move. And because you can move your thumb anterior and then flex, you can do both at the same time, that allows you to grasp objects, right? And so that opposition motion is real important. Okay. So what other kinds of motions do I need to talk about? I think that's all the motions. Flexion, extension. Remember at the shoulder, flexion and extension is a little flaky, right, according to the general rule. But just know that it works the same way at the hip. So when you move your hip, just you'll be able to know. If you move the shoulder the same way, then you'll be in good shape. Okay, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion. Well, just as a little foreshadowing, maybe just a little bit. Let's go back to plantar flexion, dorsiflexion, just so that you don't forget it. Okay, when I lift my toes up off the ground, what do we call that? Dorsiflexion, right? Just think of some muscles that allow you to dorsiflex. And what do we call it when we push our toes into the ground? And actually, I'm lifting up my body, right, when I do that. That's plantar flexion. Right, and since that's opposite motion, antagonistic motions, and the muscles on opposite sides of your body are going to produce that antagonism. Which muscles do you think are stronger, the ones that plantar flex or the ones that dorsiflex? Plantar flex, dorsiflex. I think everybody said it, but kind of got smeared out. It's the ones that plantar flex, because when you plantar flex, what happens to your body? What do those muscles do? Yeah, they lift your whole body up. So those have to be really tremendously strong. The ones that dorsiflex only have to lift your toes up off the ground. So those are much weaker kind of muscles. Plantar flexors, and probably you realize this, are in the posterior leg, right? They look bigger. The ones that are for dorsiflexion are anterior leg. Typically not very impressive looking muscles in the anterior leg. Okay. What about some of these other joints? Shapes of joints. And these are still all synovial joints, right, or diarthroses. A plane joint, like intertarsal, intercarpal joints, which we looked at, a hinge joint, right, would be, for instance, like the elbow between the, oh, what's this part of the ulna? And this part of the humerus? Yes, let's start right here. You're right, but let's start right here. Here is the trochlea, and that fits into the trochlear notch. That's a hinge joint, right? That's just for flexion and extension. The pivot is between the ulna and radius, pretty much, and the capitulum of the humerus, right? So let's just consider the hinge joint. And of course, if it's just a hinge joint, can you, should you be able to abduct or adduct this joint?
No.
No, it's purely hinge, right? So it's just flexion and extension, for instance. All right, a pivot, and again, that's uniaxial, like the hinge is a uniaxial kind of motion, flexion and extension. Pivot is either a right rotation or left rotation, right? So it's uniaxial. A really good example of that is between C1 and C2. Or the proximal radial ulnar joint, right here, is a nice pivot joint. A condyloid, biaxial motion, like the metacarpophalangeal joints. So that's between, what, your hand and your finger. Now, what can you do? How come we just don't call that a hinge joint? Well, you can flex, right? You can flex and extend, but what else can you do? You can abduct and adduct at that joint too. Okay. So, and with those two, maybe you can get some motions in between, but basically it's just a combination of flexion and abduction, adduction. Okay. A saddle joint. That's a pretty nifty kind of joint. All right, so here's that biaxial motion between the hand and digit bones. All right, so here is that a saddle joint, right, which allows for opposition, right? So that's between a carpal and number one metacarpal, and it allows for a biaxial motion. And so you can flex, you can extend, right, and you can oppose at this particular joint just because of its shape. So there are two axes of rotation for abduction and adduction, for flexion and extension as well. And probably maybe some people in here who are mechanically inclined recognize this as what kind of joint in your toolbox or maybe your automobile in the drive shaft. This is what we call a universal joint, right? If you want to have a number of different ways of rotating to get at a particular object that you want to turn. Okay, so that would be a saddle joint. Ball and socket joint. All right, so here's a ball and socket, like in your humerus, and between the head of the humerus and the glenoid fossa. Okay, and then also, you're right, in the leg, the head of the femur. I don't think I have a picture of that one. No, I don't have a picture of that one. And so the head of the femur fits into the acetabulum. Okay, now this picture right here reminds me of, actually, it seems to be pulled off of the shoulder, but when I look at this joint right here, it reminds me more of a hip joint compared to the illustration that I see over here on the left. Why do I think this reminds me more of a hip joint than a shoulder joint? Okay, because of just how far the head of the long bone fits into the corresponding depression. So this is a really deep depression that I see. So this looks a lot more like an acetabulum to me than a glenoid fossa. All right, so here you can see that the glenoid fossa is what, shallow or deep compared to what I see on the right? It's very shallow. Right, and I think I mentioned before, it's very shallow, and that's really good for range of motion, but the trade-off is, what about strength? Yeah, it's inversely related. So range of motion increases, that means the strength decreases, because they're inversely related. Unlike between the femur and the acetabulum, range of motion decreases, but strength of the joint is increasing. Okay. So that ball and socket joint, you can flex and extend, you can abduct and adduct, you can rotate. How are you going to demonstrate rotation, for instance, at the shoulder? What's a good way to see that rotation at the shoulder? Okay, it's circumduction, abduction, flexion, extension. How are you going to show rotation? Okay, circumduction. All right, the best way to visualize it is to first flex at the elbow, like so. Right, and don't move your wrist, don't move your fingers, don't move the bones in your forearm, right? So don't pronate or supinate. And then do what? Move your hand toward midline, like that. Is anything changing in my elbow when I do that? When I do that medial rotation? No. If I do a lateral rotation like that, again, there's nothing changing in my elbow, wrist, fingers, or anything like that. It's right at the shoulder. So the humerus is just rotating medially or laterally. So that's easy to see. If you just keep your hand down by your side like that, yeah, you can rotate at the shoulder, but it might be harder to see. But if you make a nice 90-degree bend, then you can see that rotation easily. That's also a nice clinical diagnostic for damage to the shoulder joint. It's called a rotator cuff injury. Probably you all heard rotator cuff injuries, so good way to check for that is for, can a person rotate at the shoulder? So a person then will flex like that, and somebody with rotator cuff injury probably can medially rotate pretty well, but they can't laterally rotate at all without extreme pain. Okay, so just, you don't even have to apply pressure, just have somebody apply pressure to your hand, and if they can't do that, that's a pretty good sign for rotator cuff injury. Has anybody ever heard of rotator cuff injuries in here? No? I'm sure you have. I mean, I think probably you're shy. Okay. I want to go over the knee, but I want to go back to the shoulder for just a little bit, because we just see how shallow the glenoid fossa is. Okay, so where is a nice shoulder joint? Ah, here, I think this is good right here. Okay, so here is, right, here's the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity. Kind of funny they call it a cavity because it's not very deep at all. So what bone do I have the cursor? What bone has that glenoid fossa? The scapula, yeah, the scapula. All right, and you can see that the glenoid fossa is very shallow, but here is some fibrocartilage here and here. Oh, it's not labeled on this slide. Too bad. It should be. So this is what we call the glenoid labrum. So the glenoid labrum is actually a ring that completely circles the glenoid fossa, and what does it do? What does the glenoid labrum do in terms of structure? Does it make the glenoid fossa more shallow or more deep? It makes it deeper, right? So then the function of the glenoid labrum is to what? Make the shoulder weaker or stronger? It makes the shoulder stronger, right? But because it's just fibrocartilage, right, is it easy to damage compared to bone? Oh, it is. It's easy to rip that glenoid labrum pretty easily, right? And then I don't know how it's replaced. It really destabilizes the shoulder when that happens, when there is a tear to the glenoid labrum. And so just remember, glenoid labrum is in the shoulder joint. Okay. All right, so then let's go look at the knee in particular. Knee in particular is a really good exam figure that I do want you to know. Oh, here's some motions that you can look at. Knee, where's knee? Okay. Well, you're going to have to start to know some muscles at this point in time. Not too many muscles. After we talk about muscles, maybe next time this will make a lot more sense. This one here is not an exam figure, but this shows us all the superficial structures in the knee. Well, not all of them, but because I don't see any tendon sheaths or bursa on this particular illustration. But I see a number of things. I see some bones, I see some tendons, I see some ligaments, and I see some muscles. All those things are on this illustration. All right, so what part of your body is above this little bone right here, where I'm circling the cursor? Okay, oh, what did I just ask? I forget what I just asked. Okay, I forget what I asked. But anyway, so, oh, what body part is this? That's what I asked. What body part is this? Thigh. I like thigh, right? Because thigh is between your hip and your knee, right? So here is your knee, so here's your thigh. These are thigh muscles in your anterior thigh, and there happens to be four of them in this group, and so we call these the quadriceps. And what does quad mean? Four, right? So that makes perfect sense. So a lot of times muscles are really easy to memorize and learn because it just really stands out for a number of reasons, which we'll talk about pretty soon. All right, so here's the quadriceps. And here is some dense regular connective tissue that's connecting the quadriceps to the patella. All right, so what do we call that structure? Muscle to bone is a tendon. So here's tendon of the quadriceps. We just name it after these muscles. All right, and here's patella. That's your kneecap. And then here is some more dense regular connective tissue between the patella and the tibia. Those of you who have had lab already today, you know this to be, what is this structure here? Tibial tuberosity, right? So it's a pretty massive process. It's very rough because inserting into it is the patellar ligament, right? A bone-to-bone connection is a ligament. All right, so that is, so here's a tendon, here's a ligament, a couple bones, and what bones are these, what bone in the thigh are these muscles attached to? Femur. Maybe I can see a little bit of a femur over here. So we got femur, we got patella, tibia, and fibula. Right. Here is a ligament that goes from the femur down to the fibula. And then here is another ligament that goes from the femur down to the tibia. And so those I want you to know. So let's maybe get to an illustration that shows these a little bit better. Don't necessarily like this orientation, but this is your exam figure, right? Because it shows all the bones. How many bones are there here?
Two.
I see four. Do you see four? Okay. Here is the femur, right? So here are the condyles, the medial lateral condyle of the femur. So here's one. Then I see the patella. That's two. Here's the tibia. Three. And the fibula.
Four.
I think that's what I said. Yeah, I said four. Okay, so I see four bones. I don't see any muscles. Okay, but now I see, I see one little tendon right here. It's been cut and the patella has been reflected down away from the interior of the knee joint so we can look in there. Here's some nice hyaline cartilage on the articular surface of the patella. Nice hyaline cartilage on the articular surface of the condyles of the femur. Right, and so here's a ligament. We've mentioned before, between the femur and the fibula, and it just runs straight superior and inferior. We're going to call that a collateral ligament. Collateral, because it lines up with the femur and the fibula when it is extended. And you know this to be the lateral ligament, right? Because the fibula is lateral, so another reason why you got to remember which is medial and lateral. Sometimes this is called the lateral collateral ligament, or you could say fibular collateral ligament. That's exactly the same thing, and people probably use those both of those terms in the same sentence sometimes, right? So lateral collateral and fibular collateral ligament are the same. You have another collateral ligament, but it is medial. And so here is the medial collateral ligament. Or you could call it what? The tibial collateral ligament. So again, you just got to know these bones in the leg. All right, so tibia, if you just say tibia and fibula, don't say tibial, but if you just say tibia and fibula, right, fibula is lateral. One way you can maybe remember that is because there's an L in fibula. All right, but depends on what kind of memory you have. You might need a little trick. All right, so you got two collateral ligaments, medial and lateral. Don't forget, tibia is medial. And then you have some ligaments that go from the intercondylar notch in the femur down to that intercondylar eminence on the tibia, which we talked about last time. And what can you tell me? What letter of the alphabet do these two ligaments form? They form, does it form a C? A T, an X. Yeah, maybe it's hard to see, but here is the posterior, here is the anterior ligament, right? And since they cross over each other, we call these the cruciate ligaments. So cruciate ligaments are deep inside the knee, the collateral are on the outside. All right, so these collateral ligaments prevent usually what kind of motion at the knee? How do they stabilize the knee? What kind of motions do these collateral ligaments prevent? Bending at the knee, how? Abduction, adduction, right? So collateral prevent abduction and adduction. If trauma ever is applied to the knee, to where the knee abducts or adducts, then of course those ligaments have to rip off or rip themselves or rip off the bones. Okay, what about these cruciate ligaments? They're not good for preventing abduction and adduction, but okay, this anterior cruciate ligament, since it's attached to the anterior head of the humerus and posterior on the femur, it prevents, what do we call that motion when a bone, you push a bone forward, like your mandible? Protraction, right? So this anterior cruciate ligament prevents protraction of the knee, and the posterior cruciate ligament then prevents, okay, yeah, the retraction of the knee. Okay, but if there, again, is trauma to the knee that protracts or retracts at the knee, remember the knee is basically a hinge joint, but if it's pushed forward or pushed backwards, then it's going to damage these cruciate ligaments. And all those injuries are fairly common to the knee. Even though it's just a hinge joint, right, there, it's still not a very, very strong joint. Even with all these ligaments, tendons going across. And also in the knee, we see these C C-shaped cartilages made out of fibrocartilage, and these are what we call the menisci. And you got to know which one is medial and lateral, but that's okay because you know medial and lateral of the tibia and fibula right here, so that's easy to know. All right, notice, here is the tip of one of the menisci, like the tip of the letter C. As it moves laterally, it gets thicker. Also notice, as you move from this interior part of a meniscus to a more exterior part, it also gets thicker. So it has like two different kind of wedge shapes to it. Right, as you go from tip to the middle part of the meniscus, it gets thicker. But if you go from edge to edge, it also gets thicker as well. So when a meniscus is damaged, could you guess what part of the meniscus is usually damaged? The thick part or a thin part? It's usually a thin part, right? And it's usually these ends of a meniscus that get ripped off. And then you have that wedge. And if you have a wedge floating around inside a knee, can you guess what might happen to the motion of this knee? It might actually lock up because that, like we use a wedge up in the anatomy lab to keep a door open. These little wedges can get stuck in different parts of the knee as well. Okay. And then you need some surgery to remove that. I don't know of any good surgery that repairs a meniscus. There might be some by today. Usually when somebody had a torn or damaged meniscus, they would remove the whole meniscus, right? And then a person would have the hyaline cartilage of the femur riding up against the hyaline cartilage of the tibia, and eventually that cartilage would wear away and would produce what? Arthritis of the knee, right? Which is really terrible condition. So nowadays, when somebody goes in to remove some part of a meniscus, guess what they'd like to leave behind? As much meniscus as possible to prevent what later in life? Arthritis, right? So as much of the meniscus is spared as possible for that particular person, okay? Because knee replacements are pretty common, usually very successful, but if you don't have to go through it, then don't volunteer for it, obviously, right? Okay. Okay, so that's the knee. That's the important joint that we're going to look at in lab as well. Know some of the important features of that shoulder joint, like what, the glenoid labrum, the bursa, tendon sheaths, and things like that. And the sign-in sheet is going around, so please make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I know a couple students have asked a day or two after lecture, can you sign me into the sign-in sheet? But I have no idea who is here, so please do it now.